Today is August 20th, 2009. We are at the Amelia Island Museum of History, 233 South 3rd Street in Fernandina Beach, Florida, 32034. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Edgar N. Livingston, born October 26, 1931, in Fernandina Beach, Florida. My name is Frank Reitinger, and I will interview the subject on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Don Hill, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. Okay, Ed, if you'll start off telling us what was your period of service, and then just take it from there. Start from the beginning.
All right. In 1949, I was a junior in high school, and someone came along and said, the Navy is really looking for people. They have a terrible time getting anybody to enlist. And said, but if you would enlist, you can go to these meetings and they will pay you some money and all. Well, that's back in those days, jobs weren't easy to come by, especially if you were in high school. So several of us, matter of fact, Jim Hosier and Perkinson and a few other guys went down and we enlisted. And so we didn't think much about it. I went to my first drill, and at my first drill, it was a inspection. I didn't have a uniform. I didn't have anything. But, you know, we struggled through that thing. But as we progressed, the war to end all wars was over. In June, and I went to all the meetings, and it was fun. In June of 1950, the North Koreans overran South Korea. And suddenly, everybody's world went upside down. I had just graduated from high school, and I was in this squadron, and I guess I should back up again, excuse me. In 1949, I went to boot camp at the Atlanta Naval Air Station, excuse me, which lasted for 89 days, in which I, you know, received a seaman recruit category. I then attended all of my meetings, and then to back up, I went, the Korean War started, which was entirely different from what we were used to. Suddenly, everybody is thinking that we're going tomorrow, and we thought we were going tomorrow, and then we didn't go, and so after we had, this had gone on for about 2 months, I went to the commanding officer, and I said, listen, I said, I would like to go into the Navy. And he said, well, you're in the Navy, in the reserves. And I said, yeah. And I told him that, you know, I'd like. He said, why do that? He said, you've already made airmen now. And he said, you would have to go back to boot camp. You would lose that. You'd have to start all over again. He said, we're going to be mobilized just any day now. He said, so you're way ahead of the game. His name was Mr. Acock. He was a full commander in the Navy in those days. I'll never forget him. Wonderful man. From that point on, we all went home. We packed our bags, and we waited to go. And I didn't have a job. And I don't know if anybody remembers how hard it was if you were 1A in the Navy Reserve, to walk down the streets and try to find a job. You know, everybody would want to hire you until you told them what you were, and they said, we can't take you, son, because, you know, you're gone. So finally, an outfit by the name of the United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company hired me as a mail clerk. Meanwhile, I'm attending all these meetings, and so now we're having, it's September of 1950, and we're going on our first cruise. You know, that's what they call the two-week encampments with anybody else. And, by the way, I was a Navy man. I wanted to be on a ship. And And my brother had been a Corsair pilot in World War II, a fighter pilot. He had been killed in 1945. So, you know, I really didn't have any love to, you know, fly airplanes. So we were off on this cruise, and they posted the names of who was to do what. And sure enough, who was to be the second mech is what they used to call. You had a first mech, they called him the flight engineer, and you had a second mech. He was the guy that checked everything else out. And I was put on that thing, and you know, you don't back out the Navy, and they told you you had to go fly, and I went and flew. And so that was my first experience. And by the way, I really love flying, you know. It was really wonderful. Well, this, you know, this goes on for a little while. In that same year, one of the trips I took was to Norfolk, Virginia, what they call Breezy Point. And we had to pick up these in this old PBY, and we had to pick up these magnesium flares. I forget what they were, 2.5 million candle power or something like that. When they went out to sea, you know, that's what they dumped out of the plane and searched for submarines. I will always remember the night that we took off from Breezy Point across that big big railroad marshaling yard there. And all it had in it was just gasoline cars by the thousand. I think I could have reached down and taken the cap off of one of those things. We were so overloaded and low. But I wanted to tell you, the man that flew that plane that night was named, I think it was Richard Rattery, and he was a commander. And Richard Rattery was the son-in-law of Lucius Clay, General Lucius Clay, who, you know, took care of that. Well, the following night, we didn't get back home until, back to our station until about 3 o'clock in the morning. And the next night, the next day, you know, you're looking who's to do what, and I was scheduled, Mr. Rattery was scheduled to go out in on one of these 12-hour navigation things. And then you know, they kept changing these things, and all of a sudden my name was off and somebody else was on there. I'm sorry to say that plane crashed that night on takeoff, and Mr. Rattery was killed, and several of my, you know, good friends, which, you know, really... I just had to get that in because he was a wonderful man. And the guy who taught me all about PBYs was named Cigar Smitty. He was an old first class, and he taught everybody how to do the sea anchors and things like that. Well, from that point on, you know, it was typical. You know, you work all day, and you go to reserve meetings on the weekend. You go to two-week encampments. And in the meanwhile, we were flying PBYs. We were the last squadron in the United States organized to fly PBYs. And I loved it. The plane was designed in about 1932, so it was not very mechanical in so far as a lot of automatic things were concerned. Other radios were so bad on the PBYs that you didn't communicate really with the pilot and co-pilot, because the flight engineer sat quite a bit back between the tail, between the wing and the fuselage. The way you communicated with them, they had an annunciator panel, which, you know, you flip switches to tell them that you were changing the mixture ratio, whatever it is. But you had to crank everything. And, for instance, on landing, the worst thing you could do to the 1830 engine is to cool it down too fast. So what you had to do is you had to constantly watch those gauges, and the cranks were down below about knee level, and you had to just, you know, just crank them back and forth. So by the time you landed, sometimes you'd be pretty worn out just from taking those cranks around.
And those were for cowl flaps?
No, this was for the, for the cowl flaps. Cowl flaps. Excuse me. Anyhow, we flew in the PBY. You know, we had a great joke about it. The PBY took off at 80 knots, cruised at 80 knots, climbed at 80 knots, descended at 80 knots, landed at 80 knots, and stalled at 80 knots. It wasn't a real fast plane, but it would stay in the air forever and forever. And so we had those up and through about 1955. And then they decided that we needed to be upgraded, and they brought in the P-2V, which was a much bigger, hotter airplane. And I qualified as a flight engineer on that. And so I used to go extra meetings, extra reserve time to learn how to be a flight mechanic on those planes, or a flight engineer. They were a great plane. One of the things I did is I was the flight engineer on the P-2V that followed the last PBY to Litchfield Park, Arizona, where it was parked. And then we took that crew back. And I always remember we got on the airplane and kissed it goodbye. Really quietly. So the a number of things happened, but I have nothing of any interest to tell you. But I was just like many other guys in my squadron. We were just never called up. We were to have been called up and activated in June of 1952. We were to go to somewhere in Formosa to replace a Navy squadron there from Seattle, Washington. You know, they were rotating. In the meanwhile, Mr. Eisenhower was elected president, and he ended that war. And so that was it. So,
what was your, when you're flying the P-2s, what was your typical pre-flight experiences, and then what did you do en route? What were you training to do?
Well, the pre-flight on those, you know, you really had to, a big air, well, any plane, you know, you had to really walk around. You had to check all the tires for any cuts or anything like that. Make sure all the battens were off the controls. You know, just to inspect the, especially the P-2Vs had that big nose landing gear, and it was a very complex thing. You want to make sure everything was, you know, really good on it, because it did not free fall. It had to swing out into the airstream. So if it didn't work right, you had a problem. In fact, one of our people did have a problem with one. He got quite an award for figuring out how to get that darn wheel down. It was but you went around and, you know, you gassed them. You were responsible for all the oil on it, batteries, radios working, you know, just intercoms working. And took you about, I'd say, to properly do it, it took you at least a half an hour or more, you know, to really go around and look at a plane. P-2Vs had what they called Fowler flaps. In addition, in regular flaps, just sort of plop down out of an airplane. Fowler flaps extended the wing, and then they rolled down. But they didn't necessarily always roll down at the same degree and the same time. So that was one of the things our second mechanic had to do, is sit back there, and there were stripes on it to make sure that the flaps came down at an equal rate. Meanwhile, I squatted as a flight engineer between the pilot and the co-pilot. There wasn't a chair for me. You just had to sort of squat there. And in front of you were these panels that opened up, and where the gas was. You were responsible for maintenance of the gas. If you were to lose an engine on takeoff or something like that, you had to know which valve to turn it, you know, and how fast to turn it. In the meanwhile, you know, you also inspected all the engine instruments as you ran down the runway to make sure he was getting the power that he needed. And then from that point on, you know, you just, when you flew, you just never took your eyes off the dials. You let the pilots do the flying, and you did the, you know, mechanical work, so nothing would sneak up on you.
What would you do on your typical mission once you got going?
Well, most of them were just orientation missions, let the pilots get in a lot of times. But when we were on our cruises or on special occasions, we would go out for maybe, you know, 12 hours, fly around, go out to the ocean, let the navigators shoot the stars and do things like that. and just look around. You know, what you're doing is you're looking, you're trying to get orientated. Here you are in an airplane. You want to know, how would you look at, how would you sight a ship? How would you do this and that? Nothing very formal.
Did they have any anti-submarine detection equipment on that airplane?
The ones that we used were called the P2V3W Hunter. In those planes with the solid nose, we had these instrumentation that you could track the radar that a submarine might have been giving off, anything like that. Then there was another P2V that we didn't have any. Other squadrons had that, which was called the Killer. The Killer came along with the Hunter. The Hunter found him, and the Killer theoretically dropped the depth charges or whatever it was. But you know what happened on that is, they figured that if we could find the radar off of a Russian submarine and fly down that radar beam to get him, there was nothing to keep him from sending a rocket right up that radar beam. So that obsoleted that thing, you know, pretty fast.
Did you have the jet engines on yours?
At the very last, when I was getting out, we then got the P2V5Ws, and they had jet engines. They had two J34 Westinghouse axial flow jet engines, which were wonderful because you never had to sweat a takeoff again. At 50 knots, they produced more than 3,000 horsepower each. You know, so you could lose a piston engine and keep on going. The piston engines that we had on there were R3350s made by Curtiss Wright. And we did not, the 5Ws had compound engines. They produced about 3,000 horsepower apiece. Ours were not compounded, and they produced somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2,700 RPM, I mean horsepower apiece. Powerful engines. Same ones they used on the B-29 in World War II and all.
And, did you lose many engines?
You know, I never lost one
never?
Engine. I had one engine to really crap on me one time, but it blew a whole bunch of black smoke out, and then it, you know, just, we were taking off, and I mean, it, you could see the, what we call a brake mean effective pressure gauge, I think Air Force called torque meter. You can see that thing dropping like crazy and the RPM starting to go off, and then all of a sudden it just started blowing black smoke out, and suddenly everything came back.
So when did you use the jets?
The jets you used for takeoff. That's what they were for, because the 5Ws carried so much more. They were a heavy plane. They were armed to take nuclear bombs on them and everything. They were just a heavier plane. They had mad detection gear at the back end, you know, so they were substantially more than the, say, the ones that I put most of my time in.
Mm-hmm. Would they start them up for the approach and landing in case they needed them? Or?
Not that I was on. Okay. The best thing that I would always remember, they would practice, the pilots loved to practice emergency takeoff. Short field runway, and when you get 6,000 horsepower going with the piston engine, another 6,000 horsepower with those jet engine. By the way, they didn't produce that horsepower till you got to 50 knots, and that's what they do. You take off with your flaps up, and you roll down that runway, and when he got to about 40 knots, you'd start rolling those flaps down, and when he started rolling them down, he started pulling back on that stick, and you literally went straight up in the air. I say straight up, you know, no plane could do that.
Now you were based at Peace Street Academy?
Peace Street Academy, which was a Naval Air Station.
What was it called then?
The Atlanta Naval Air Station.
Okay. Uh-huh. And then where did you go when you did your two-week cruise?
Well, we went to Brunswick, Maine.
Who?
Went to Detroit, Michigan. Went to, what's the name of that place in California?
Moffitt?
No, there's a racetrack there now. I can't think of the name of it, but it was near El Toro, but it was a naval place. Los Alamitos, that's what it was, Los Alamitos.
Los Alamitos, yeah.
We did several right at Atlanta because, you know, we could do everything out of there. But.
Did you do much down here at Northeast Florida?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, well, I probably left out the best part. The PBY was an amphibian. So we used to come down to the St. John's River and practice water landings. And we'd go basically, you know, if you know where St. Vincent's Hospital is now, we would basically go over St. Vincent's Hospital, you know, because it's a long stretch, and we would land on the water. We would take off and go up about 200 or 300 feet high, and then he would go back down again and make another landing and do that. But watching the pilots make these landings, you know, you create a tremendous suction on the hulls of these things. Those poor guys had to work like crazy. And, of course, you had to work like crazy to make sure those engines didn't overheat when you were doing that. But we did that a number of times. And almost sunk once because the gasket on the Stinger gun port on the bottom of the PBY, was rotted out and started taking a lot of water before. But that's different. Anyhow, in 1957, I got married. And my wife didn't want anything to do with me doing that. Child on the way and everything. So I sent them a nice little letter, and they wrote me a letter back and said that. But to wind up my very uneventful thing, the Korean War was ended. But in 1961... I had gone to work for the General Electric Company, and I was living in New Orleans in an apartment. And I traveled a big area, and I came home on a Friday evening about 6 o'clock. I walked in the apartment's front door, and there's two Navy guys sitting on my sofa there, two enlisted men. And I said, "What's going on here?" to myself. They got up and introduced themselves, and they said, "We're expecting bad things in Berlin. We really think that we're going to have to reinstitute the airlift to supply Berlin with the thing." Said, "We were going through," he said, "you got a few days left on your enlistment." And he said, "But they were going through anybody that could be a flight engineer on any of this stuff." He said, "Would you consider coming back in?" "Sure I would." But my dad was there. And my dad said, "Son, you have 3 kids now." He said, "You've done your share," he said. And so I like to place it on my dad that I didn't go back in. I probably wouldn't have gone back in anyhow. And so that was really my career, and I think in... what was my termination date? Wasn't it 61?
It was April of 61.
In April of 61, I got my final honorable discharge papers, and that ended my military career, which I loved every minute of it, because if I can divest something, I served with an awful lot of guys who had served in the South Pacific in World War II. Talk about real heroes. Pilots, enlisted men. We had one guy named Bill Campbell, and I think he made just about every major battle in the South Pacific as a tail gunner and a SBD, you know, a Douglas dive bomber.
Yeah.
And I mean, he told tales like, you know, you wouldn't believe.
Well, even the guys that were flying PBYs in the Pacific, they were dropping torpedoes and such, weren't they?
The Black Cat Squadrons were really famous. As a matter of fact, they wanted to make a movie out of them, and I got a letter from the commanding officer of my squadron asking me if I'd like to be in a movie, but it never came to fruition. And, you know, they asked all of us if we would take PBYs and go out to wherever they were going to make it, somewhere in Florida, make a history of the might catch what they did. Never came to fruition on that.
Did you, in the PBY, did you make any rough water landings? I mean, what was your limitations?
No, the St. John's River was always like a pond. In fact, it was so smooth that they had old PT boats, you know, big old, whatever you want to call it. And those guys had to run back and forth across the river to make waves so that the PBY, so the seaplanes could get bust the suction on their hulls and get off.
That's amazing.
But some of the people, some of the pilots that flew PBYs, we had a lot of them that had been in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And that was rough duty. And yeah, they made some pretty rough landings, I understand. Because one guy told me, he said, they always made sure they had a big supply of number two pencils. Because when they hit the water so hard, it popped the rivets out. And the only thing they could do in an emergency is they put number two pencils in the hole, the rivet popped out of them, and break them off until, you know, that would be a thing. Can I divest one more time?
Oh, help yourself.
One of my best friends was an officer. His name was, well, we called him Pete Cochran. His name was Paul Cochran, lieutenant commander. He'd come to us from a dive bombing squadron. They used old Martin Maulers, but he had aged out of those or something. I forget. So those guys didn't want to get out. They came over multi-engine. Pete, and well, I should be more respectful, but he was a wonderful man, and he told me that he was in the Navy, stationed on some carrier in the Atlantic in 1941. Or 42, and he said, and he loved to fly, and he said his pilot said, son, I noticed that every time we take off, by the way, he was a rear gunner on a SBD, said every time we take off, you're sitting in the back seat. Why? He said, I love to fly. He said, why don't you become a pilot? He said, I don't have the education. He said, they wouldn't take me for pilot school. He said, you really want to be in it? He said, yes. He said, two or three days later, he got orders cut to go to flight school. Seems as though his pilot was the son-in-law of Admiral King. He ran a whole darn Navy. But he was at Tarawa, and he tells a story at Tarawa. And I think this is, he said, he flew a TBM, an Avenger, and they were making a dive bombing run from, you know, 20,000 feet up, trying to pinpoint these pillboxes. And he said, as they passed through about 10,000, 8,000 feet, a Marine squadron, of Corsairs, came across there on a rocket run. And he said, just one of those things, they fired their rockets just as our TBMs went right through them. And he said, it went in the rear. He said, I know it killed my two guys, knocked the wing off. And he said, I was going around like a, he said, just, he said, I don't remember doing it. He said, I evidently popped my seatbelt and the centrifugal force threw me out. And he said, I remember the parachute popped just as I hit the water.
Wow.
And he said, if you think I'm scared? He said, that didn't scare me half as much as I look up. And he says, this is American Navy destroyer, belching black smoke like you wouldn't believe. And that mother is headed straight for me. He said, that captain took that darn destroyer practically up on the beach. And he said, he had these trained swimmers. And he said, they were over the side. And I was back on that destroyer. And that destroyer was backing off with every gun shooting. And he said, I just thought that was just a story I could not. I want somebody to preserve it, at least for Pete Cochran's sake.
Wow.
So anyhow, I probably exhausted all of my Navy things, except I think it's a wonderful country. Back in those days, everybody was patriotic.
As a young teenager, you lived here.
No, as a young teenager, I lived in Decatur, Georgia.
Oh, okay.
No, my dad was transferred when I was about 2 years old to Atlanta, so I was really reared in the Atlanta area.
Okay, so you
but I came back here every summer, you know, and my uncle by marriage, Tom O'Hagan, was a lighthouse keeper here, so used to come back maybe spend a month at least in the summer times there.
Did you ever see any activity of the U-boats off the coast or
torpedoes? No, but when you went swimming during the war and you got out of the ocean, you would usually have oil globs on your bathing suit. A number of ships were sunk off, some of them over the horizon. The worst one, though, was everybody knows about the one right off Jacksonville, where it was illuminated by the party they were having in Jacksonville that night, and the submarine got it. But
yeah, we had a neighbor who was there that night and saw it blow up, and the next morning the flotsam and jetsam and bodies were floating up on the beach.
And the trouble is, you know, that ought to prove to everybody how ill-prepared we were to go to war. We had a naval air station right over there. And, you know, they were building it, but, you know, you'd have thought they'd have had something for coastal defense in those days. But we were really caught with our pants down.
Yeah, we were.
By the way, the Coast Guard did have a detachment of 12 guys here at the lighthouse. You know, they took eight-hour shifts. There was somebody in that light, four of them in that lighthouse all the time, looking for submarines and relaying, you know, coded messages up and down the coast and things like that. It was very interesting. Hmm. When you drove to the beach in those days in your car, all car headlights were painted black halfway down. When you got to 14th Street going to the beach, even those lights had to be turned off, and the only way you could drive was with your parking lights on.
Wow.
And they had... Does anybody know Mary Holt Boswell?
Yes.
Mary Holt Johnson Boswell? Mary Holt is my age. We took Red Cross swimming together, lessons. And she used to be an aircraft spotter. They had quite a little stand out at it.
Yeah, we've interviewed her.
Okay. You have?
Yes.
She can probably tell you a lot more than I can. But, you know, it's... I can remember air raid blackouts in Atlanta when they used to practice, you know, the air raid warden. Every block had his warden, and the guy had a white hat and a thing and walked around. And, you know, boy, you had to have those lights out. They were really afraid, you know, back in those days, you know, right after Pearl Harbor and the Germans declared, they didn't know what was going to happen. They really didn't know if it was going to be saboteurs or...
Yeah, I remember I read that they had a Coast Guard mounted patrol on the beach.
Oh, yeah, excuse me. I didn't know too much about that. But yeah, they did.
I read that somewhere because they had landed the Germans down at Ponte Vedra. One set of Germans were landed there first from a submarine, so they really got concerned about that.
Yeah, they had a horse patrol, and I was never out there when they came by because we knew better to get off, but you better not be on that beach, and I think it was an hour before sundown. Wow. You know, they would really literally run you off. I believe there's stables and all, and where they have that boys' home up the north end of the beach. I think that's where they were.
When you were coming here for the summers in those days, did you see much activity out at the Fernandina Airport? Were you in tune with that at all?
That was like another world, you know. Yeah. I had a great uncle that lived in Amelia City, down, you know, in Manusi's a part of my family. He was my great uncle, you know, they all lived down there. And we used to go see him once a year, but I never recall seeing one airplane. Huh. I do remember that the old road we used to go on had been changed, and now we had to go a circular route because of the airport. But, you know, you'd have really thought that we'd have seen a lot more, but apparently they came from Jacksonville, landed, loaded up with the ammunition, took off and went straight out to sea, and there wasn't even buzzing around town.
Yeah, it was an auxiliary field. They just came in and refueled and rearmed and went out.
assault was destroyed, the rearmed. They didn't want a bomb going off in the middle of Jacksonville when one of them crashed. But that's a long time ago. I'm 77 years old, pushing 78.
Well, you're doing great.
I'll say.
You got anything you want to?
No, I think it's just it's great. Could you take 2 or 3 minutes maybe and describe the crew on the P2V? You know, you talked about yourself and what your functions were, and you had a pilot and a co-pilot. Who else was embarked with you?
Well, on the P2V, we had a pilot and a co-pilot, and a flight engineer and a second mech. That was a flight crew.
That was it.
Yeah. The second mech, you know, would relieve the flight engineer. You know, he was always in training, or maybe he was the same rate, rank, and education training as everyone. And then we would have a navigator. We would have a gunner. Sometimes we would just have 2 or 3 guys that just wanted to go flying.
Where was the gun?
The gun was, we had a power turret in the top of the airplane. And it was, well, let me divest. Let me tell you this. We used to go out for gunnery practice every once in a while. We had 150 caliber machine gun. They wouldn't put the two of them in there. Remember I talked about this guy, Bill Campbell, being a gunner on a rear gun on a TV, I mean a SVD. Well, we're out there, and what you do is you'd smoke, throw a smoke flare out. We were over the ocean, you know, somewhere 50 miles out of Savannah or something. We'd throw the smoke flare out, and these so-called gunners would get in that turret, and, you know, the only thing you were worried about, would they shoot the tail? Would the interrupter work to keep them from shooting the tail of the airplane? Well, they had shot about, I don't know how many times. And, of course, we're flying around this very tight circle. And finally, old Bill Campbell said, "Do you guys want to see how it's done?" And somebody said, "Yes, yeah, smart ass, you know, get in there." Bill Campbell got in that turret. And this is no lie. As you know, every third shell out of a 50 caliber was a tracer. You know, so the guy would not. Bill Campbell got in that thing and pulled that trigger. And he blew that smoke pod out of the water before the first tracer got there.
Good grief.
And so everybody believed all those war stories he told all of his life. But, you know, the PBY, you had a pilot and a co-pilot, flight engineer, and a second mech, 2 gunners, and usually, did I say navigator?
Navigator.
And a radar operator. You know, I think our crew was 9 or 10 on the PBY. On the P2V, you know, we didn't have everybody most of the time, but the starboard side of the airplane had a long desk-like thing with the 4 seats on it. And it had all these electronic countermeasure things on it that I never saw one of those countermeasure guys, so...
Yeah.
You know, we usually didn't have them, but if had we gone out, those guys would have been on those planes, and they operated the mad gear or whatever they needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Any more?
That's great.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of our nation, and thank you for your service. This concludes the interview with Ed Livingston.
Thank you very much.